As Betty said, my subject tonight is cracking the Gnostic code. Now, at lunch, I was asked to please define Gnosticism in one sentence. And I said, that depends on whether you mean the general sense of Gnosticism or a particular sense of it. In the general sense, it is what Betty mentioned. It is a religious philosophy which says that salvation or redemption or enlightenment or whatever one calls it comes from a direct, personal, immediate experience of the way things really are. In a particular sense, it refers especially to a congeries or a collection of systems of thought of that type, which developed during the first three centuries of the common or Christian era, about the same time as and in the same place that Christianity was developing. And it's that that I'm going to be talking about particularly tonight. In the general sense, Gnosticism is found all over the world at all times. It's very widespread. But tonight we'll be looking particularly at the rather special sense of Gnosticism. And that special sense is shown forth quite dramatically in a recent book. Actually, it's an old book called Echoes from the Gnosis, which was written by a man by the name of G.R.S. Meade, who had been H.P. Blavatsky's secretary at the end of her life. We have republished that early work. The early work was actually in 11 little volumes. We've gathered them all together, and we have some really good introductory material, especially by someone who many of you will know, Stephen Heller, who's a great American authority on Gnosticism, and also by an Englishman whom you will not know, I think, most of you, but who is very much of an authority on Meade. So much of what I am saying will be a kind of commentary on or introduction to what's in that little book. Now, Gnosticism is, I have called it, a code. It is, in fact, a code of the archetypes which all of us have deep inside of us. But that code is hard to access. Archetypes are difficult to view directly. They are a little bit like God. So instead, we have codes by which we recognize the archetypes. There are many such codes, of which Gnosticism is only one. Now, the word Gnosticism and Gnostic comes to us from Greek, the Greek word gnosis, there are two different traditions. There are many different traditions for pronouncing both Greek and Latin, and I'm going to use the English pronunciation of them, the traditional English pronunciation, which in this case is gnosis. And gnosis is a Greek word which means knowing, recognizing, having acquaintance with. It comes, in fact, from an Indo-European root. Indo-European is the very ancient language from which Greek, Latin, English, French, Russian, Sanskrit, Persian, and a lot of other languages developed over a period of time in ancient days. And that Indo-European root, they were illiterate, so they didn't write it at all, but we write it for them as G-N-O. And that Indo-European root occurs in a number of English words, which come straight from Indo-European, most prominently the verb to know, K-N-O-W. But we also have it from a number of Latin words. I'm not going to read all these. I don't want to take time. But you can see them on the screen, and you will gather that all of them have something to do with knowing, with recognizing, with experiencing. And we also have them with a number of words which we have borrowed from Greek. And of those other words, I'm only going to comment on one, which is this one. G-N-O-M-O-N. Does anybody here know what the English word G-N-O-M-O-N means? It's pronounced gnomon. Anybody know what a gnomon is? Well, I would be amazed if anybody did. It's not a very common word, but the thing which it names is not at all unusual. You all have seen sundials, right? Which tell us the time of day by the shadow which is cast. And that shadow is cast by a little object, which is sort of a triangular-shaped object. This familiar to everybody? Yes. That object is a gnomon. The name for that little... Everything's got a name, even though we may not know the names always. The name of that little object is gnomon. And why is it called a gnomon? Because it lets you know what the time of day is. Now, why should we bother about Gnosticism at all? Well, there are a number of reasons. One is that it is one of the major archetypal codes of the world. And it is through looking at these archetypal codes that we can discover what the archetypes are like. And it's such an important one that it's worth paying attention to for that reason. Also, for theosophists, Madame Blavatsky was well acquainted with Gnosticism, and she writes about it very often. In addition, however, that specific variety of Gnosticism, the one that flourished during the first three centuries of our era, was very influential on Christianity. And in Christianity was very influential on it. So much so that the early church fathers came to regard Gnosticism as simply a Christian heresy. That's not true. It was an independent origin, and perhaps it probably is older than Christianity somewhat. But they were very closely connected during those first three centuries, and they were very influential on one another. The Gospel of St. John and all of the epistles of St. John are very heavily Gnostic. That's recognized by biblical scholars. But the last reason that I think we might pay some attention to Gnosticism is one which came as a surprise to me, but several scholarly authorities on religion have said that Gnosticism is one of the four world religions. Now, you must understand what they mean by world religion here. A world religion is one which expands outside the cultural milieu in which it began, and which is propagated by vigorous proselytizing, by missionaries who go out and spread it. And there have only been four of those in the history of the world. And so here are the four world religions. The first is Buddhism. Right? Began in northern India and then spread all over the world. The next two were Christianity and Gnosticism, which developed in the same general area about the same time. But the particular branch of Gnosticism which became a world religion is one called Manichaeism, which developed in southern Iraq and spread all over. It spread to China. It spread all the way to Spain and to Western Europe. And then the fourth world religion is, of course, Islam. So we know a lot about Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam. We know not much about Manichaeism, and particularly Gnosticism, of which it was a variety, because it's the one, the only one of the four, which has not survived. Now, since Gnosticism is concerned with gnosis, or this direct experience, I think it's worth having a look at the gnosis as a path. In Hinduism, there are three paths, or margas. The first one in Hinduism is the Jnanamarga, or the path of knowledge. And indeed, there are three paths in Christianity. And the first one is the path of gnosis. The second path in Hinduism is the Bhakti Marga, or the path of devotion. And that corresponds in Christianity with the path of faith. The third in Hinduism is the karma marga, or the path of action, and that corresponds with the path of good works in Christianity. But now notice there is a sharp difference. In Hinduism, these three paths are all regarded as equal. You can travel any one of them. You can travel all three at once. And indeed, the Bhagavad Gita, which is the great spiritual work of Hinduism, combines all three of these paths. It talks about all three of them. It combines them. But in Christianity, gnosis was early branded a heresy. And we'll see why that is in just a minute. A little later, good works was also branded as a heresy. Good works was promoted by a Christian theologian by the name of Pelagius, and his teaching came to be known as Pelagianism. And what Pelagius said was that we are not in trouble because of what Adam and Eve did. We're in trouble because of what we do. And the church said, no, no, that's not true. We're in trouble because of what Adam and Eve did. And the Christian church settled on faith as the only acceptable path. Now, we'll look at that a little. We'll compare now conventional Christianity with classical Gnosticism. And the most obvious difference is that in Gnosticism, the way to enlightenment or salvation or redemption is by a direct personal experience of the way things really are, of truth. Whereas in Christianity, the way to salvation is what? Faith, right? Faith becomes the only path. Now, in Christianity, faith is embodied in creeds, creedal statements, statements of I believe. In Gnosticism, gnosis is embodied in myths. And that's a sizable difference, because nobody thinks that myths are literally true. The church believes that creeds are saying things which are literally true. Right? So that when you recite the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, the intent of the church is that you believe every word in those creeds as literal statements. Gnosticism says, no, the myths are there, but the myths are stories. They are not literal statements. They are not history. They are stories with a moral. And then another difference is that if you have faith embodied in creeds, then everybody has got to believe the same creed. Right? And so Christianity puts great stress on orthodoxy, which is correct opinion. Gnosticism, if you have myths and it depends upon a personal experience, what is the result going to be? Great diversity of opinion. And then finally, the faith as defined by the creeds in which everybody must accept results in the organization of the church. And so the organization of the church becomes a central focus. But in Gnosticism, since it's a personal experience embodied in myths with the consequent diversity of views, what is the center of focus is the experience of the individual. Can you see why the early church fathers didn't like Gnosticism? Because if personal experience is what leads to salvation, then what need is there for this? So it's unnecessary. Now, what I'm showing you on the screen is a diagram called the Chart of the Pleroma, according to one of the early Gnostic teachers, Valentinus. This diagram strikes me as being very, very much like something which one finds in Hinduism, which is called a yantra. Yantras are geometrical diagrams consisting of triangles and other shapes, all interlaced and very complex and very symbolic. This is a kind of Gnostic yantra. And I don't know where it came from. Madame Blavatsky gave it in some commentary she wrote on a translation of an early Gnostic work called the Pistis Sophia, which was translated into English by G.R.S. Mead. And in her commentary, she gives this diagram. I have no idea where she got it, but I am going to come back to this diagram repeatedly because it's going to be the focus for what I say about Gnosticism. I think it's a remarkably interesting thing. What I have done here is simply to color it, right? I took my magic markers and colored it in order to so that we can see the parts of the diagram more clearly than you can if they are simply in black and white. Now, the back of that diagram, let's go back and look at it. What do you see here in the background? Circle. Well, there's a circle around it, but I mean, what's all of this? Blank, right? Whiteness. emptiness. And that's the first important concept in Gnosticism. The ground of all things is something which in Gnosticism is called the psyche. And psyche is simply a Greek word meaning silence. But that corresponds to what Madame Blavatsky calls parabrahm, to the ground of being. It is the silence from which the voice of the silence comes. That's a little spiritual classic by Madame Blavatsky, The Voice of the Silence. So the silence is the underlying reality which appears in all being. And so here is the psyche, right? And on the psyche, there is something very prominent, this, within the blue circle, and that is called the pleroma. And the pleroma is a word in Greek which means fullness, completeness, entireness. And also at the bottom of the pleroma, there's something else down there, and we'll come to that in just a little moment, that little addition. That is called the hysterema. And the hysterema means imperfection. The pleroma is the world of perfection or of archetypes. The hysterema is the world of imperfection. Which of those two worlds do we live in, please? We're way down here, right? And there's this other world, this world of the archetypes, the world of perfection, which we'd like to get to. And indeed, salvation or redemption or enlightenment consists in our getting out of the world of imperfection into the world of the pleroma, the world of the archetypes of perfection. Notice that the hysterema is not an ugly world, right? There are great beauties in it. There's pain and suffering in it, but also great beauty and great joy in it. But it's imperfect. And so if we want to reach perfection, we have to crawl through and get out of it. All right, so again, here is the pleroma, and here is the hysterema. We're going to talk about, and also here, notice at the very top of the pleroma, there's a little red triangle. And we're going to begin very shortly talking about that. But the pleroma is inhabited by some wonderful beings. In Greek, they are called the eons. Now, eon in Latin, borrowed that term, is eon. And the eons, the word eon means an immense period of time, but it also means a world, and it also means a being who lives for that immense period of time in that world. The eons are, in effect, the gods of the ancient. They are the archangels of the Christian tradition, or they are what in theosophy are called the Dian Chohans. They are intelligences who live in the world of perfection. So here is the world in which the eons live, and we're going to be talking about them for a bit now. Now let's come to that triangle at the top. At the very top of that triangle, there's a red dot, and that red dot is called, the Greek term is bythos, which means the depth. And it is, in effect, the first or unmanifested logos. It is the beginning of the operation of the divine in an active way, but not yet active. And then the second part of this triangle is the nous, which means mind in Greek, and it's the second or manifest logos. And the third part is the aletheia, which is a Greek word meaning truth, which is the third or manifesting logos. There are said to be three logoi, the unmanifest, the manifested, and the one which is causing manifestation. And those last two are connected with one another, making the first trinity. So if we come back to our diagram, there are these three eons forming that initial one. Now we're going to look at some of the others, because the pleroma also includes a square which has four angles, and that's going to represent four eons. It also includes a five-pointed star, which has 10 angles, right? Five at the tips and five opposite the tips. And that will represent 10 eons. And it also includes a pair of interlaced triangles, or a hexagram, which have 12 angles. All right, let's start looking at some of these. If we look at the square, first of all, the square represents what in theosophy is referred to as the first outpouring, which is the creation of matter. Not dead matter, for theosophy says that all matter is alive. All matter has life in it. And in the ancient days in Europe, in the Western tradition, all matter was said to result from four qualities: hot and cold, dry and wet. So water, for example, is wet and cold, fire is hot and dry, and so on. So there are the four qualities. The Greeks talked about these four qualities. They talked about in the Middle Ages. They talked about in the Renaissance. They dominated thought about physics in Western thought right until the rise of modern science. And that square in the center of the pleroma, that green square, represents the potentiality of living matter. Not actual matter, but its potential, right? Now, the next thing we will look at is, in fact, that five-pointed star. The five-pointed star represents what in theosophy is called the second outpouring. The second outpouring takes that living matter and molds it into intelligent forms, makes forms out of it. Forms of what? Well, of minerals, vegetables, animals, us, and things which are lower than minerals and things which are higher than us. So there is that five-pointed star in the middle of the pleroma. And now let's look at the interlaced triangles, which are there also. The interlaced triangles represent what in theosophy is called the third outpouring. First you have living matter, which is brought into existence, and then out of that living matter, forms are fashioned into which intelligence can be developed, but so far they have no spiritual component in them. And eventually, in the third outpouring, something happens which is called individualization, and you and I are the result of that third outpouring. The third outpouring begins with the downward pointing triangle, which represents the forms built out of living matter, and into it comes the upward pointing triangle, which represents spiritual reality. And what are we really? Which of these two aspects of us? We are both. Is a totality? We are both. Absolutely. But which of the two makes us what we truly are? If we are only this, what are we? We're just animals. Right? But with that, we become beings with spiritual potential. All right, so we're back to our diagram now, and we're going to add one thing to it. Up top here, there are two little circles attached to that primordial triangle, and those are the last of the two eons to come into existence. And they are very important ones because they guide the evolution of the world, according to Gnosticism. One of them is called Christos. And the other one is called Pneuma. Pneuma, that's P-N-E-U-M-A, which is the Greek word for spirit. And Christos is clearly associated with the word for Christ, but that word, in fact, is older than Christianity. And also, one other thing we haven't talked about, and that's this little appendage down here, which is the world we live in, the world of imperfection. There is a Gnostic myth, and the myth has many forms, so I'm going to give you very quickly a generic form of the myth. And the myth says that after the Pleroma had come into existence and had been emanated from that initial depth, which is also called the Unknown Father, because it's the origin of everything else in the Pleroma. After all that had happened, the lowest of the eons was one whose name was Sophia. What does Sophia mean? Wisdom. But Sophia wasn't all that wise, actually, because she decided she wanted to imitate the Unknown Father and to make a world. And so she did just that. She created matter, but she didn't know how to do anything else. And so it was a pretty sad world she created. And then she made something called a demiurge, or she begat something called a demiurge, and told him to get with it, fill that world with something. And so he did the best he could, and he created forms. But they were unspiritual forms. And the Unknown Father took pity on this misbegotten world down here, and he sent Pneuma and Christos into it to give spiritual potential to the forms which had been created. Now, the creator of this world, the offspring of Sophia, in one of the traditions of Gnosticism, is called Abraxas. And incidentally, the Greek letters all correspond to numbers, just as Hebrew letters do. And if you take the Greek letters for Abraxas and transform them into numbers, you will get the number 365. And what is the significance of 365? The number of days in the year. So Abraxas is the god of time, the god of time of our world. He is traditionally shown as a figure with the head of a cock, a whip, a shield, and serpents instead of legs. Now, I want to tell you something that I think is really very important. Because if we don't keep this in mind, we get into problems. There's a very fine author by the name of Pamela Travers. Does the name Pamela Travers mean anything to anybody? Anybody know who Pamela Travers was? Beg pardon? God bless you. Somebody knows. Pamela Travers was the author of the Mary Poppins books. Is Mary Poppins familiar to everybody? Now, you know, we know Mary Poppins primarily through the film which was made with Julie Andrews, right? It's a delightful film. I love the film. But it is not a very faithful reproduction of the Mary Poppins books. Pamela Andrews, I'll tell you a little, how I discovered this. I didn't know it. I'd seen the film and thought it was a lovely film, and that was all there was to that. But a couple of years ago, my wife and I were in London, and there was a new musical opening, which was a musical based on Mary Poppins, which is now playing in New York. And there was a review of it. And the review mentioned that the author, Pamela Travers, had been a follower of an Irish poet by the name of George Russell. Does that ring any bells for anybody? George Russell is better known by his pen name, A.E. He was a student of Madame Blavatsky's. He was one of the Irish theosophists. I said, well, if Pamela Travers was a follower of A.E., there's got to be some theosophy in those books. So I immediately bought all of the Mary Poppins books, and I have started reading other things by Pamela Travers. She was a very prolific writer. She was very much interested in mythology. She wrote books on mythology. There's a lot of mythology in the Mary Poppins books. And the Mary Poppins books are basically very theosophical. Each of the books has a wonderful scene in it, which is about the unity of all life. And that's the theme of the whole series of Mary Poppins books. Extremely theosophical. All right. Pamela Travers, in one of her essays on mythology, said something which I think we should all learn and repeat to ourselves daily. She said, there are three rules for interpreting archetypal symbols, because all mythology consists of archetypal symbols, right? There are three rules, she said, for interpreting archetypal symbols. The first is, don't take them literally. The second is, don't take them literally. And the third is, do not take them literally. So remember how it does Gnosticism express itself? Not in creeds, but in myths. Don't take them literally. Don't believe that any of the ancient Gnostics believed that there was a god called Abraxas. This is all a mythological statement. And so what one has to do is intuit what lies behind the mythology. Now, Gnosticism is often said to be dualistic. And that, I think, is at least in part a misunderstanding. It is certainly concerned with polarities. Now, there are many different kinds of polarities in the world. The Chinese type of polarity, which is best known, is the yin-yang polarity. And you all will be familiar with that. Remember this symbol? It's the great Chinese symbol. That symbol is called the Taiji, or the Supreme Ultimate. And it consists of one half, which is black, and one half, which is white. And in each half, what is there? A seed of the other, right? The black half is the yin. The white half is the yang. Can you have a supreme ultimate with only one of the two halves? No. Both are necessary. That's the point of Chinese polarity. And that's very theosophical, all right? You can't have matter and spirit, matter without spirit. You can't have spirit without matter. They go together. Now, another kind of polarity is that of Indian Hindu Vedanta, which says that there is Sat, which is truth, and Maya, which is illusions. And people misunderstand what Maya means. Maya doesn't mean something which is unreal. As a matter of fact, Maya, the word Maya, comes from a root which means to make. Maya are things which are made, but which are not what they seem to be. So there are things which are what they seem to be, which is Sat or truth, and then there are Maya or illusions, which are not unreal, it's just they ain't what you think they are. You will be familiar with, I'm sure, many of you, with the famous story illustrating what Maya is. A man comes into a dark room and he sees a cobra coiled in the corner. And he's terrified. So he runs out of the room and he gets a torch and he to defend himself against the cobra. And he goes back in and he holds the torch up and what does he discover? It's not a cobra at all. It's just a pile of rope in the corner, right? Is the rope unreal? No, it's real. But the cobra is not. It's a misperception. So that's what all of Maya is. It's simply a misunderstanding of what is real. That leads us into the motto of the Theosophical Society, which is there is no religion higher than truth, and that word there is satya, or sat. All right, another kind of polarity is that which Plato talked about, which was that of a contrast between the ideal or perfect world and our actual or imperfect world. And then we come to the Gnostic version. which is certainly polarities. It says the great polarities are spiritual knowledge versus material ignorance. Right? And as long as we are concerned with matter only, we are ignorant. Why? Because matter is where Maya occurs. Then there was a very dualistic kind of system which developed in Iran among Zoroastrianism, at least one variety of Zoroastrianism, which said that there is a great polarity in the world, which is good versus evil. And this is not the same thing as spirit versus matter, because in Zoroastrianism, there is good spirit and bad spirit, good matter and bad matter. Right? So they are not the same at all. But it is true that a variety of Gnosticism, often called Iranian Gnosticism, developed, which confused good in spirit and evil in matter and said that there is good spirit versus evil matter. And that's the kind of Gnosticism which is often written of today. But that, in fact, is only a minority type. Real Gnosticism is concerned with spiritual knowledge versus material ignorance. Now, to make that point, here is a very famous Gnostic gem. It's a design on a gem or a stone. And what is this thing we've got here? It's what the Greeks called an Ouroboros, which is a serpent with its tail in its mouth. And, of course, we've got that in the Theosophical Seal. That's the circle of the Theosophical Seal. But notice the Gnostic serpent is rather interesting. What are its color? What is its color? It's half black and half white. Does that suggest the Chinese yin-yang? Two halves are both. Can you have a serpent without a tail? Can you have a serpent without a mouth? You have to have both. And they have to be, at some point, united, which is the point of the tail in the serpent's mouth. And in the center of this is a Greek motto. And I'll tell you, it took me a long time to figure out what that said, because that's very ancient and obscure writing. But I finally came to the wonderful realization that what that says is what in modern Greek letters would be written, or in classical Greek letters, would be written as hen topan. And hen topan is one of the great mottos in alchemy and also in Gnosticism, and it means all is one. All right? So is Gnosticism dualistic? No, not basically, because it says all is one. And that's the basic proposition of theosophy, and it's the basic proposition of most of the great mystical systems of the world. Now, Gnosticism and theosophy are really quite similar in a number of ways. For example, in what they've got to say about the human constitution. Gnosticism says we are composed of three elements. The first element is the pneuma, or spirit. Remember I said that was one of the eons? That the hidden father, the unknown father, took pity on these poor critters that Abraxas made. Those poor critters are you and me. And he sent down Pneuma, the spirit, into them. And that spirit corresponds to what in theosophy is called Atma-Buddhi, Atma and Buddhi. Right? The spirit and the insight, the wisdom, which recognizes spirit. And then Gnosticism said we have a second part, which is the psyche, and that's a good Greek word everybody knows, right, because we get psychology from it. It means soul, and that corresponds to what in theosophy is called the manas, or the mind, and the kama, or the emotions. So it's the emotional mind. And then Gnosticism said there is also something called hyle, and hyle means simply matter, and that corresponds to what in the theosophical tradition is called prana, which is the energy of life, and the linga sharira, which is the form which molds our physical body. So some real similarities there. Gnostics said that all human beings... One group of Gnostics said that all human beings are of one of three kinds. They are hylic, or psychic, or pneumatic. But in fact, all human beings are all three. We've all got pneuma. And hence we are pneumatic. Incidentally, we've got that word, don't we, in English? Which refers to air, right? Or spirit. And we're all psychic, and we're all hylic. We've got all three in us. And what must we do? We must align all three, right? So that they all work together. Why? Hen topan, all is one. Right, now, this is a Gnostic cross of great interest. There are two words written on the Gnostic cross. From top to bottom is the word, the word in Greek, phos. Phos. And the Greek word phos means light. We've got it in English in phosphorescent, right? What does phosphorescent mean? Glowing with light, right? With internal light. And then the crossbar has the Greek word zoe. And that Greek word zoe means life. And we've got that word in English too. You know, English is a terrible thief. It takes words from languages all over the world and makes them English. What English words have we got that have the Greek word zoe in them? Well, how about zoology, which is study of living beings, right? Okay. And there's some other words too, but that's the best known one. Now, what's interesting about this is that phos, or light, is in the vertical. And where does light come from? From above, right? So it represents spirit. And zoe is on the horizontal. And what does the horizontal represent? Matter. Right? So life develops in matter. Zoe, phos, spirit, matter. But what is the thing which unites light and life? What is that letter right in the middle? It is the last letter of the Greek alphabet. And the last letter of the Greek alphabet is omega. And what does omega symbolize? From alpha to omega. The Omega Principle was a book published a few years ago. Omega is the end point. It's where everything is moving. It's the end, the purpose. So what is the purpose of light, our spirit, and zoe, our matter, life, our matter? It is their union. The union of light and life, of spirit and matter. And it is that union toward which the whole world moves. And that is the essential Gnostic discovery. Right? When one realizes the unity, when one, not intellectually, that doesn't do you any good. Gnosis is not intellectual knowledge. It's not information. I'm giving you information. That's worthless. Right? What is the only important thing? Knowing in the sense of a personal experience. Knowing for yourself. Not because somebody has told you something, but because you have discovered it, you have realized it, you have come in contact with it. And that's what Gnosis is. It is a coming into contact with the ultimate, the final purpose of light and life. Now, how do we make that discovery? Well, if we're on our own, we have a lot of trouble doing it. Because you and I, well, I shouldn't say you, maybe this isn't you, I'm a dumb bunny. I don't really know what to do as long as I'm on my own. So I need somebody to help me. And so what the unknown father, remember that little point, the depth at the very top of the triangle? What the unknown father does is to send Christos into the world. Remember, he sent pneuma, which was life, a spirit, to make us spiritual beings when before we were only material ones. And then he sends Christos into the world. And Christos comes not once. The Gnostics regarded Christ as an incarnation of Christos, but there are lots of incarnations of Christos. All of the great spiritual traditions of teachers of the world are incarnations of Christos, whether they are in the Hindu tradition or the Buddhist tradition or the Old Testament tradition, whether they are in the Chinese tradition, Confucius was a great Christos, whether they are in the great mythological tradition of Hinduism, Krishna with his partner, his spouse, Radha. And that's very good, because here we've got yang and yin, right? That's a great Christos. And in the Gnostic tradition, one of the Christoses was Mani. And Mani was the fellow who founded Manichaeism, which became one of the four great world religions. Right? Now, what is the function of the Christos, of the world teacher, in the Gnostic tradition? In Christianity, we know what it is. What is the function of Christ? Christ dies for our sins, right? And we are saved by believing, having faith in Christ. No, that's not what the Gnostics say the function of Christos is. They say the function of Christos, in whatever form Christos takes, is to save himself. Christos is saving himself in the world. And in so doing, he's showing us how to do it. Right? He's the teacher. And he teaches not with words, but with actions. He lives a life which he calls us to live. And by living the life of Christos, we get saved. Not because we believe in Christos, but because we recognize, we know, we experience what it is that Christos has also experienced. So the Gnostic liberator is a self-liberator. The Gnostic savior is a self-savior. But in the process of saving and liberating himself, he liberates and saves us through his example. Okay, let me summarize what I've been saying about Gnosticism. And all good summaries have to come in sevens, right? In the Theosophical Hall. First of all, there's a difference between Gnosis and Gnosticism. Gnosis is a matter of the direct experience of the way things really are. Gnosticism, whatever form it may be, is a formulation of that experience. Right? So there are lots of Gnosticisms because there are lots of formulations. There is only one experience, but it gets interpreted in lots of ways. Gnosticism is not concerned with creeds. It's not concerned with what you believe. It's concerned instead with myths, with stories that embody that experience. You all know some of the modern promoters of mythology, don't you? Joseph Campbell, for example. Joseph Campbell was a great Gnostic because he uses myths to convey spiritual truths. There is a ground of all being, which is the silence. And you can't say anything about it, because it's the silence. But from it emerge both a perfect world, a world of archetypes, and an imperfect world, which is the world in which we live. And what we need to do is to get out of this and into that. The perfect world has in it an unknown father and all the eons. And these are this is, in effect, the divine mind, or the archetypes. The world is created by Sophia, by wisdom, but it's an imperfect wisdom, working through a demiurge, her offspring. Now, please notice, the demiurge is not a bad guy. He's not evil. He's not a villain. But he's just like you and me. He makes mistakes. He does the best he can, but he's got limitations. That's the Gnostic view of the world. Right? It's an imperfect world because it was created by an imperfect person, an imperfect spiritual person, but still imperfect. there are in the human being pneumatic, psychic, and hylic elements. And in any given human being, one or other of these may be prominent. But we've all got all of them in us. And which is the one we need to develop? The pneumatic, because that leads us to a perception of gnosis. And there is a liberated liberator. Christ, Confucius, the Buddha, Krishna, all of the great spiritual teachers of the world liberated themselves by the way they lived. And through that process of living, they taught us how to do it too. And that's what I've got to say about Gnosticism. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John, and I know that there are going to be some questions, so I take it you will entertain a few questions.
I will be entertained by them.
You will be entertained by them. We will want to get your question on the mic, so if you have a question, please raise your hand, and then I will bring the mic to you. I'll give you a minute to think. We've had quite a bit of experience here.
Thank you for taking my question. Would you say Socrates was a Gnostic? Liberated liberator?
Was Socrates a Gnostic? Was he a liberated liberator?
I think Socrates was very definitely a liberated liberator. He's one of the great spiritual tradition teachers of the West. In Western culture is the product of two roots. One root is Judaism, from which Christianity sprang. But the other root was Hellenism. And intellectual Hellenism is the fruit of Socrates. So that in a way, Socrates is the daddy of the West. Yeah, sure. There are numerous of these liberated liberators. Right? And notice that liberation is not an all or nothing thing. Liberation is not like going to a light switch and flicking it on or off. Right? It's rather like what is sometimes called a variac switch. You know, those little knobs that you can turn and the light will increase or will dim depending on which way you turn. That's what liberation, that's what enlightenment is like. There are degrees of it. Right?
Not until very recently it dawned on me that my grandfather was a Gnostic. And it was in Bosnia when I was 6 years old. And he'd given me some indelible lessons. And one of them was, we're looking at the stars on St. Nicholas night. And I asked for all kinds of toys. And I said to him, well, what do you want? He said, I want the kingdom of heaven. Now, that reverberated for the rest of my life.
Sure.
One of the arguments that he had with my grandmother, who was a Christian Ukrainian Orthodox, was she called him a Subotar, which means Saturdayer.
It means what?
Means this person in a Saturday, obeisance of Saturdays.
Okay.
And I wondered if it had, whether you had any knowledge in terms of the relationship of the Saturday as a, you know, relevant to Gnosticism. Did anything ever come up in your...
Offhand, nothing specific occurs to me. I will make a couple of comments, though. Gnosticism, which I've been talking about in particular, was this thing which developed in the first three centuries of the modern era. But it didn't come to the end. It went on, so that you get... Historically, there were waves, influences from that early Gnosticism that turned up in Spain and in the south of France among the Cathars, lots in Bulgaria and in that area of Eastern Europe where there were Gnostic groups right up until quite recent times. So Gnosticism was around for a long while. Now, as for the Saturday, of course, the days of the week are named after Roman gods or planets. And Saturn is the god of time and of space. And so that, you know, has echoes with the Gnostic view of both the silence, which is what underlies everything, and indeed even Abraxas, who is the god of time. And Abraxas is not a bad guy. Let me emphasize that, right? There were certain Gnostics who decided that Abraxas was really evil, right? And that the world was an evil place created by an evil being. But they were just one group of Gnostics. They weren't the main group. The main group regarded the world as an imperfect place, but that doesn't mean it's evil, right? Imperfection is not evil. You want to do away with it. You want to make it perfect, but that doesn't mean it's evil.
My question is
close.
My question is that was part of my question is, are there currently practicing Gnostics in the world, or is it known by another name? And then there's a second part. Do they leave any signposts as to how one might come to this knowing? Mm. Because it strikes me that so many of the world's spiritualities or religions use meditation or contemplation, because I too believe that if you can know God from without, you can also know God from within, but you have to traverse all your own archetypal lives to get to the essential truth. But are there any writings or things about what they recommend to get to this gnosis?
All right, now, the first part of your question. Actually, there is still a group of practicing Gnostics in the Middle East or the Near East, which go back to extremely early times, and they have had a continuous history. They are the Mandeans, who are in Iraq and in Syria, around there. They are often thought of, again, as being Christian heretics, but they deny that absolutely. They say they aren't Christians at all. They trace their history from John the Baptist, right? They're baptizers, but not Christians, right? And they are Gnostics. And indeed, the very word Mandean in the language that these people, the traditional language they speak, means gnosis, knowledge. So that's a group which has still exists and has existed for 2,000 years at least, maybe more.
Huh?
No, I don't think so. They're a very tight little community, actually. Now, the other thing is that Gnosticism began to capture the interest of people in the late 19th century. That's when G.R.S. Mead, who did a lot of translation of early Gnostic documents into English, got interested in it. But lots of other people got interested in it about that same time, the late 19th century, the early 20th, and Gnostic churches were formed. And so there was a kind of revival of Gnosticism. We might call this neo-Gnosticism, right? Because it did not have that kind of historical continuity that the Mandeans had. But they went back to the ancient documents and recreated a kind of Gnosticism. And that's what Stefan Heller is involved with, actually. It's one of the recreations. As for the techniques, that's really hard to say, because all of us would like to have a nice little list of things we can do which would make us enlightened, right? Would you please give me a list of 7 things I can do, at the end of which I will be enlightened? I would like that, and I assume many of you would too. But unfortunately, there is no such list. Why not? Because although all of us are fundamentally, basically the same, all of us are the same in different ways, right? We are each unique. And so we each have to find our own path. And this is a very important theosophical concept. Krishnamurti, a great contemporary spiritual teacher who came out of the theosophical tradition, gave a famous talk in the late 1920s in which he said, "Truth is a pathless land." Yeah? Now, Madame Blavatsky had a wonderful statement, which begins, "There is a road, steep and thorny, but there is a road." Now, who's right? Madame Blavatsky, who says there is a road, or Krishnamurti, who says truth is a pathless land? They're both right. They're talking about different things, right? There is, in fact, a road, but there's not one road that can be defined by seven steps, right? Each of us has to create our own roads. There's a wonderful poem by a Spanish poet. Let's see if I can remember it. I remember part of it in Spanish. Caminante, no hay camino. Se hace el camino por andar. Traveler, there is no trail. You make the trail by treading it. All right? That's why there is both a pathless land and yet there is a way. Right? And we make the way by doing it. How do we do it? Well, that each of us has to discover for ourselves. And of course, one way, as you point out, that the great spiritual teachers have told us to discover that is by meditation. And what is meditation? Meditation is getting very, very quiet. It is getting in touch with the silence, the sige, the ground of being. And the ground of being is not out there. Where is the ground of being to be found? Where do we find the ground of being? Inside ourselves. Because it's the same thing inside as it is outside. So we find our path by going within ourselves. But the great teachers have done that, and they've shown us. So we are not isolated and left alone. We follow the path which they indicated, but it has to be our own path.
We have one more question back here.
Hi. One time I had walked into a Christian fundamentalist church, and I had mentioned that I sometimes engage in the practice of fasting, and I was therefore labeled to be a Gnostic and therefore dualistic in my practice. And I guess my question is, are there Gnostics which are actually dualistic? Is that a strain of Gnosticism, or is that strictly misperception? Are there any Gnostics that are dualistic, or is that completely false?
I don't know of any current Gnostics that are strict dualists, but there have in the past been some, if we judge by some of the Gnostic writings. See, Gnosticism is not one thing, right? It's not a single coherent movement. It's a lot of different movements over a long period of time which share certain features that allow them all to be called Gnostic. But they were quite different from one another because they did not insist on uniformity. They were not concerned with orthodoxy. They valued diversity. This is very apparent in that Gnostic library which was dug up in Egypt some years ago, the Nag Hammadi texts. The Nag Hammadi texts are extremely varied. They contradict one another. And yet they were all sacred texts of this Gnostic community in Egypt. The Gnostics were not concerned with contradictions. They were concerned with myths. Right? And myths can be contradictory. But they point to truth. And truth is beyond anything which can be put into words. Truth can be experienced, but it cannot be stated.